Osho, the grass grows by itself. Talks on Zen, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 8.
Bhagwan, Ninagawa Shinzayamon, a linked verse poet and devotee of Zen, desired to become a disciple of the remarkable master Ikkyu, who was abbot of the Oak Koji in Murasaki no, Violet Field. He called upon Ikkyu, and the following dialogue took place at the temple entrance. Ikkyu, who are you? Ninagawa, a devotee of Buddhism. You are from? Your region. Ah, and what's happening there these days? The crows caw, the sparrows twitter. And where do you think you are now? In a field dyed deep violet. Why? Miscanthus, morning glories, safflowers, chrysanthemums, asters. And after they're gone? It's Mayagino, the field of autumn flowering. What happens in that field? The stream flows through, the wind sweeps over. Amazed at Ninagawa's Zen-like speech, Ikkyu led him to his room and served him tea. Then he spoke this impromptu verse. I want to serve you delicacies. Alas, the Zen sect can offer nothing. At which the visitor replied, the mind which treats me to nothing is the original void, a delicacy of delicacies. Deeply moved, the master said, my son, you are a delicacy of delicacies. Deeply moved, the master said, my son, you have learnt much.
Poetry is closer to religion than theology. Imagination nearer than reason. Of course, religion transcends both. It is neither. But through logic, to drop into the abyss of religion is a little bit difficult, because the logic has a rigidity about it. It is not flexible. It is closed, not open. It has no windows, no doors to go out of itself. It is like a grave. One can die within it, but one cannot move into a living process. One cannot become more alive through it. Logic is a straight jacket, a prison. Poetry is closer because it is more flexible, liquid, more flowing. It is not religion, but you can drop out of it more easily than from logic. It has openings, doors and windows, and fresh winds always can reach into the deepest core of the heart of a poet. Poetry is not rigid. You can drop out of it if you like, it will not cling to you. And because it is imaginative, it can stumble upon, even unknowingly, on the unknown. It goes on groping in the dark. It is a groping in the dark. But it goes on groping. It goes on searching. It is always ready to move into any new dimension. Logic is resistant. You cannot find more orthodox people than logicians. They will never listen to the new dimension opening. They will not even look at it. They will simply say it is not possible. All that is possible, they think, is already known. All that can happen has already happened. They are always suspicious of the unknown. At the heart of a poet is always in love with the unknown. He goes on groping in the dark for something new, something original, something untested before, unlived, unexperienced. A poet gropes. Sometimes he can stumble upon the unknown. He can fall into the abyss of religion. Poetry is metaphorical. It lives through metaphors. Same is the language of religion. Of course, when a metaphor is used in a poetic way, it means something else. And when it is used in a religious way, it means something else. But both use metaphors. There is a meeting ground. Their meanings may differ, but their methods are of the same family. They look like twins. Vast is the difference within, but at least at the form, at the surface, they are more alike than logic and religion. Because of this likeness, religion has always spoken in the way of the poet. Upanishads, Vedas, Kabir, Mira, Zen poets who have written beautiful haikus, so condensed that a vast poetic world becomes like a seed in a haiku. Sometimes very simple. You cannot even catch the significance immediately. But if you ponder over, meditate upon, then by and by, the small haiku becomes a door. I was just reading a few days before Basso's famous haiku. It is very small, but if you meditate upon it, suddenly a door opens. The haiku is old pond, frog jump in, water sound. Just visualize an old pond, very ancient. A frog jumps in, the water sounds. Finished. Nothing more to say. A whole situation condensed. If you meditate on it, suddenly you will feel a silence surrounding you. It is object to art. Something will change within you. Zen poets, Sufi mystics, Hindu saints, they have all spoken in the language of the poetry. And even if sometimes a Buddha is there, and a Mahavir, and a Jesus, and they don't speak the language of the poetry, but the poetry is there, whether they speak it or not. If you listen to them, you will feel a certain poetic quality underneath their words. Their prose is only on the surface. The form is of the prose, but the spirit is of the poetry. In fact, one who is enlightened cannot do otherwise. If he speaks in prose, he can, but he cannot avoid poetry. The poetry will be there just beneath the surface. If you have a little insight, you will see it. It is vibrant and alive there. Religion and poetry have the same language. Their worlds differ, but somewhere they have a meeting point. And that meeting point is the story of this story. A poet comes to meet a Zen master. Must have been a very great poet, because only the highest and the greatest poets can have that meeting ground with the mystic. Each and every poet will not have that, because where the poetry becomes ultimate, there is the first step of mysticism. When the poetry ends, culminates, reaches its peak, its Gauri Shankar, becomes the Everest, there is the first step of the temple of the mystic. Highest poetry is the lowest mysticism. There is the meeting point. So only very great poets can attain to that height, where a Zen master will have to say, "My son, you have learned much. Now we should enter into this." Ninagawa, Sinhaman, a linked verse poet and devotee of Zen, desired to become a disciple of the remarkable master Ikkyu, who was abbot of the Daito Kuzu in Murasaki-no Violet Field. This has been always my feeling, that the greatest of the poets cannot avoid religion. They have to come into it, because poetry leads to a certain point. Beyond that is religion. If you persist in being a poet, you will become religious. You can remain a poet only if you have not traveled the whole extent of it. So only small poets can remain poets. Great poets are bound to move into religion. You cannot escape it, because a certain point comes where the poetry ends and religion begins. if you follow up to that extent, where you will go? At that moment, poetry converts itself into religion. One has to follow, and the same happens to a logician, to a scientist, but in a different way. A scientist also, if he persists, goes on and on and on, there comes a moment where he feels a cul-de-sac. The road moves nowhere. Now there comes an abyss. There is no more road ahead. It is different with a poet. There is road ahead, but now it is no more of poetry. His road automatically converts into the road of the religion. But for a scientist, a logician, or a philosopher, it happens in a different way. He comes to a cul-de-sac. The road simply ends. It goes no more. Further, there is no road. A precipice, an abyss. This happened to Albert Einstein in his last days, because it can happen to the greatest. The lesser minds on the same road never reach to the cul-de-sac point. They die somewhere on the road, believing that the road was leading somewhere, because still there was road ahead of them. The conversion happens only to the greatest. In the last days of Albert Einstein's life, he started feeling that his whole life has been a wastage. Somebody asked that if you are born again, what you would like to be? He said, never again a scientist. Rather, I would like to be a plumber. But never again a scientist. Finished. In the last days, he started thinking about God, or the ultimate meaning of life, the mystery of mysteries. And he said that the more I have penetrated into the mystery of existence, the more and more I felt that the mystery is eternal, unending, infinite. The more I came to know, the less I became certain about my knowledge. The mystery is vast, cannot be exhausted. This is what the concept of God is, the mysterious, the vast, which cannot be exhausted. You can know and know and know, and still it remains unknown. You move into it and go in and in and in, and still you are moving in the periphery. You go on dropping into it, but there is no bottom to it. You never exactly reach to the center of mystery. Never comes a moment when you can say, I have known all. Nobody has said that except fools. A wise man starts feeling more and more ignorant. Only fools gather few things from here and there and start thinking that they know. Only fools are knowers, claimers of knowledge. Even in a scientific search, the moment comes when the road leads nowhere. Then suddenly there is a jump. A poet can move into religion without any jump. he can simply slip. The roots are linked together, but a scientist has to take a jump, a total about turn, 360 degrees. He has to go completely upside down, inside out, outside in. But a poet can simply slip like a snake slipping out of his old skin. That's why I say poetry is closer to religion. This man, Ninagawa, must have been a very, very great poet. Hence, he became interested into Zen meditation. If poetry doesn't lead you to meditation, it is not poetry. At the most, it may be a clever composition of words, but no poetry in it. You may be a good linguist, a good composer, a good grammarian, one who knows all the rules how to make poetry. But you are not a poet, because poetry in its deepest core is meditative. A poet is not a composer. A poet is a visionary. He doesn't compose. The poetry happens to him in certain moments. Those moments are of meditation. In fact, when the poet is not, then the poetry happens. When the poet is completely absent, suddenly he is filled with something unknown, unasked. Suddenly something of the unknown has entered in him. A fresh breeze has come into his house. No, he has to translate this fresh breeze into language. He is not a composer, he is a translator. A poet is a translator. Something happens inside his being, he translates it into language, into words. Something wordless stirs within. It is more like a feeling and less like a thought. It is less in the head and more in the heart. A poet is very courageous. To live with the heart is the deepest courage. The word courage is very interesting. It comes from a Latin root car. It means the heart. The word courage comes from the root car. Car means the heart. To be courageous means to live with the heart. And weaklings, only weaklings live with the head. Afraid, they create a security of logic around them. Fearful, they close every window and door with theology, concepts, words, theories, and inside them they hide. The way of the heart is the way of courage. It is to live in insecurity. It is to live in love, trust. It is to move in the unknown. It is leaving the past and allowing the future to be. Courage is to move on dangerous paths. Life is dangerous. Only cowards can avoid the danger, but then they are already dead. A person who is alive, really alive, vitally alive, will always move into the unknown. The danger is there, he will take the risk. The heart is always ready to take the risk. The heart is a gambler. The head is a businessman. The head always calculates, it is cunning. The heart is non-calculating. This English word courage is beautiful, very interesting. To live through the heart is the meaning. A poet lives through the heart. By and by, in the heart he starts listening to the sounds of the unknown. The head cannot listen, it is very far away from the unknown. The head is filled with the known. What is your mind? All that you have known. It is the past, the dead, that which has gone. Mind is nothing but the accumulated past, the memory. Heart is the future. Heart is always the hope. Heart is always somewhere in the future. Head thinks about the past. Heart dreams about the future. And I tell you, the present is nearer to the future than to the past. That's why I say that the poet is the nearest to religion. Philosophy, logic, metaphysics, theology, science, all belong to the past, the known. Poetry, music, dance, arts, all the arts belong to the future. Religion belongs to the present. And I tell you, future is nearer to the present than the past. Because the past is already gone. The future is to come. The future is yet to be. The future has yet the possibility. It will come. It is already coming. Every moment it is becoming the present. Every moment the future is becoming the present. And the present is becoming the past. The past has no possibility. It has been used. You have already moved away from it. It is exhausted. It is a dead thing. It is like a grave. Future is like a seed. It is coming, ever coming, always reaching and meeting with the present. You are always moving. The present is nothing but a movement into the future. It is already the step that you have uplifted. It is going into the future. Poetry is concerned with the possibility, hope, dream. It is nearer. This man, Ninagawa, must have been a great poet. Because why I say he must have been a great poet? I have not read his poetry. I don't know what he wrote. But I say he must have been a great poet, because he became interested in Zen. And not only that, he desired to become a disciple of a remarkable master, Ikkyu. To be interested in Zen is not enough unless you become a disciple. To be interested in religion is not enough. It is good, but it doesn't go very far. Interest remains a curiosity. Interest remains mental. Unless you take a jump into commitment, unless you become a disciple, to become a disciple is a great decision. It is no ordinary decision. Very difficult, almost an impossible decision. I always said to become a disciple is the most impossible revolution. Because how one can trust another? And how can one leave his own life in the hands of another? It is the most impossible revolution, but it happens. And when it happens, it is beautiful. Nothing like it. But only those who are very courageous, almost daredevils, only they can take the step. It is not for cowards. It is not for head-oriented people. It is for those who live in the heart. For those who have courage. Those who can risk. This is the greatest gamble ever. Because you risk your total life. You give yourself to somebody, you don't know who he is. You cannot know. You may feel certain things, but you can never be certain about the master. Always a doubt remains. In spite of the doubt, one has to take the jump. The doubt cannot be satisfied. No. You can hide it, but you cannot convince the doubting part. Because how can you convince it? You have to be with the master only then that the doubt will disappear. Before it, it is not possible. Only experience will help it to disappear. How can you convince it? The mind always hesitates. People come to me and they ask that we are hesitating 50-50. What to do? Should we wait? If they wait, they can wait forever. Because if they are thinking that they will take the jump only when the mind is 100% certain, convinced, then they will never take. Because the mind can never be 100%, that is the nature of the mind. It is always divided, fragmented. It can never be total. That is the difference between heart and mind. Heart is always total, mind is always divided. Mind is a division of your being. Heart is the undivided being. Discipleship is of the heart. The mind goes on rambling and saying and suspicious and doubting. In spite of that, the chattering mind, one takes the jump. I say in spite of that. And that is the only way. You simply don't listen to it. You simply move beneath the mind, reach to the heart, and ask the heart. Discipleship is like love. It is not like a business partnership. It is not a bargain. You simply give without knowing whether something is going to happen or not, whether you will receive anything back. You don't know. You simply give. That's why it is courage. He was not only interested in Zen, he was a devotee. He loved it. Interest is of the mind, curiosity, inquiry, devotion is of the heart. And desired to become a disciple. What is becoming a disciple? What does it mean? It means I have tried and failed. I have searched and couldn't find. I have done that I could do, and I have remained the same. No transformation has happened to me. So I surrender. Now, the master will be the deciding factor, not me. I will simply follow him like a shadow. Whatsoever he says, I will do. I will not ask for proofs. I will not ask that first convince me. I will not argue. I will simply follow in deep trust. The mind may go on still that what you are doing, this is not good. This will not lead anywhere. This is foolish. This is mad. The mind will go on saying this. But once you have taken a decision to be a disciple, you don't listen to the master, you don't listen to the mind, you listen to the master. Up to now you listen to your own mind, the ego. From now onwards you will listen to the master. Now the master will be your mind. This is the meaning of discipleship. You will put yourself aside and allow the master to penetrate into the deepest core of your being. You are no more. Now only the master is. To be a disciple means to be a sadhu, putting your ego completely aside. Ninagawa called upon Ikkyu, and the following dialogue took place at the temple entrance. Zen stories are very, very meaningful. Their every word is not there unnecessarily, even a single word. This dialogue took place at the temple entrance. First, the word dialogue. Dialogue is not just talking. It is not discussing. Dialogue is not arguing. It is not a debate. A dialogue has a different quality. A dialogue is meeting of two beings. Meeting in love. Trying to understand each other. Not trying to argue, not trying to discuss. A very sympathetic attitude. Participating in the being of the other is dialogue. Two friends talking are two lovers. With no antagonism inside, with no effort to prove yourself right and the other wrong, that continues while you are talking with people. You continue. You go on in subtle ways to prove that you are right. And the other goes on trying that he is right. Then the dialogue is not possible. Dialogue means trying to understand the other with an open mind. Dialogue is a rare phenomenon. And dialogue is beautiful because both are enriched through a dialogue. In fact, while you talk, either it can be a discussion posed opposite to each other, a verbal fight, trying to prove that I am right and you are wrong. Dialogue is different, not posed against each other, but taking each other's hand, moving together towards the truth, helping each other to find the way together. It is a cooperation, a harmonious effort to find the truth. It is not in any way a fight, not at all. It is a friendship, moving together to find the truth, helping each other to find the truth. Nobody has the truth already. Then two persons start finding, inquiring the truth together. That is dialogue, and both are enriched. And when truth is found, it is neither of me nor of you. When truth is found, it is greater than both who participated in the inquiry. It is higher than both. It surrounds both. And both are enriched. Dialogue is the beginning between a master and a disciple. And it must happen at the entrance, otherwise going into the temple is not possible. Hence the word at the entrance. It must happen at the gate. The first thing is the dialogue. If it doesn't happen, then there is no possibility of any disciplehood. Then Ikku would have said goodbye from the very entrance, because there is no need to invite the person into the temple. There is no meaning in it. So sitting on the entrance, maybe sitting just on the steps, and this dialogue happens. Ikku tried to feel the man. He has to feel the man, the potentiality, the possibility, the attitude. How deep is the inquiry? How deep is the urge to inquire? Is it just a curiosity? Is he just a philosopher? Or really a devotee? He is just trying to feel his being. And Ninagawa allowed it. He participated in it. He didn't become scared. He didn't try to defend. He didn't try to pretend something which he is not. He opened his heart to this man completely. He allowed this man to enter in him, to feel, because that's how a master has to decide whether you have come here accidentally or really you have come. The coming can be accidental. Somebody told, and you were passing by the road, you said, okay, there is time enough to go to the movie. Let us go and see who is this master is. If it is accidental, then it is better to close the relationship at the entrance, because it will lead nowhere. If the mind is argumentative, if the mind is too much filled his own ideas, then too you can become a student but not a disciple. And a master is not a teacher. He is not in search of his students. He is not running a school. He is creating a temple of the hearts. He is making a shrine, a holy, sacred phenomena he is bringing to the earth. He had to feel, and Ikku felt him very deeply, and the man proved his mettle, that he is authentic. He didn't react, he responded to the master, and whatsoever the master asked, he gave a total response to it. Those responses are beautiful. Move slowly. He called upon Ikku, and the following dialogue took place at the temple entrance. Ikku, who are you? Because that is going to be the whole search. Who I am is all religion is all about. If you already know who you are, then there is no need to bother. Or, in your ignorance, you have become identified with the name and the form, too much identified, too much filled with your name and form, then too, you are not yet mature enough for a master like Ikku to accept you. You have to go to a lesser master, in fact to a teacher, who will teach you that you are not the name, and you are not the form, and you are not the body, and this and that, and create a philosophical soil in which a master can throw the seed. You need to go to some teacher. So the first thing you could ask, who are you? Ninagawa said, a devotee of Buddhism. A very, very humble attitude. Non-claiming. He didn't say his name, that I am Ninagawa, you don't know, have not to ever heard about the greatest poet of the country, don't you read newspapers? What nonsense you are asking, who are you? Everybody knows in the country, even the emperor. And poets are very, very egoist people. Poets, writers, novelists, very crystallized egos. You cannot find more egoistic people than literally people. Very difficult to make any dialogue with them. They already know. They can teach you, but they cannot be taught. Just because they can compose few lines, just because they can write an article or a novel or a story, they start feeling too much they are somebody's. In fact, a real poet will have no ego. And if a poet has a very crystallized ego, he is not a poet at all. Because he has learned nothing out of his poetry. Even this basic truth he has not learned, that the poetry descends only when you are not. So he must be composing. He must be doing something. Poetry is like any technique. He may be a technician. He is not a poet. He can arrange beautiful verse in rhythm. He follows all the rules. He is perfect. But he is not a poet. Clever. Technically right. But deep inside, if the ego is still there, he does not know what poetry is. Because poetry happens only when you are not. In fact, a great will not claim that I am the creator of this poetry. How he can claim? Because he was not when it happened. It happened that when Coleridge died, one of the greatest poets, he left almost 40,000 pieces incomplete. A poetry he will start, a poem, three lines, and then he will stop. Then years will pass, then suddenly one day he will join two more lines, then he will stop. 40,000 incomplete poems. Just before he died, somebody asked, what have you been doing? And these are so beautiful things, why don't you complete them? He said, how can I complete? I never made them. They come. When they come, they come. When they don't come, they don't come. What can I do? They cannot be pulled. They cannot be forced to come. I don't know from where they come. Out of the blue, a line descends. Sometimes the whole poem comes in succession, sometimes not, and nothing can be done because I don't know from where they come. In fact, when they come, I am not. I am so dazed. I become just a void. So how can I complete them? That's why ancient poems exist without any signature. Nobody knows who wrote them. Who wrote the Upanishads? The greatest of poems. Who wrote them? Nobody knows. Because the authors never signatured them. They never signed them. Because they felt so humble. They are not the makers, not the creators. Asked, who are you? If he was just like other poets, ordinary poets and writers and authors, too much filled with their own egos in the mind, he would have something said, that you don't know that I am a Nobel laureate, a Nobel Prize winner. And the emperor has praised me, are appointed me as the royal poet. But no, Ninagawa said a devotee of Buddhism. He didn't talk about poets. He didn't talk about his famous name. He didn't talk about himself at all. He simply said a devotee of Buddhism. A devotee of Buddha. And a devotee. That means he said that he is here because of his heart, because of his love. He is here not because of his reasoning. He is here because of his feeling. Just a devotee. Ikkyu, you are from Ninagawa, your region. A beautiful metaphor. In fact, he was from the region, from the same part of the country from where Ikku came. But he is not talking about that. He is talking about the inner region, the inner search. Maybe you are far ahead. Maybe you have reached, and I am just a beginner. But I belong to the same region. The search is the same. I am a fellow traveler. Once your heart is filled with an urge to know the truth, you become a fellow traveler of all the Buddhas. They have reached. You will reach. Maybe it will take many and many lives, but that makes no difference. You have entered on the path. You are just at the beginning, but now you are a fellow traveler. Says Ninagawa, your region. I belong to the same part of the world to which you belong. Ikku, ah. And what is happening there these days? He goes on poking him, provoking him. Maybe he is just a pretender, trying to deceive, saying beautiful things, learned somewhere, borrowed. May have been a scholar of Zen classics where such dialogues are given. But he cannot escape. Ikku, if he is a pretender, he will fall somewhere or other. Ah, and what is happening there these days? He brings him back and back. He understands what he is talking, what he means by your reason, but he doesn't allow that. What is happening there in these days? Who has become the prime minister there? Whose wife has moved with whom? Some rumor, some gossip. What is happening there? Some events must have taken. Somebody has died. Somebody has got married. Events. What is happening there? Ninagawa. The crow's caw, the sparrow's twitter. Prime ministers, ministers and their world, the politics, the market, the economics. In fact, they are not the real history. They are just accidents. They happen on the periphery. They are not parts of eternity. They happen in time. What is eternal is the only news for those who know. And what is accidental is the only news for those who don't know. Says Munagawa, the crows caw, the sparrows twitter. This is the eternal news which has always been happening. It is happening still. Nature flows. Clouds come and go. Summer and winter. This is eternity. In the morning the sun rises, and in the evening the sun sets still. And in the night the stars in the sky and their subtle music. This is all. That is the real news. And the crows doesn't bother who has become the prime minister. And the sparrows doesn't pay a single attention to the world of events. Only man is filled with the junk. Henry Ford has said, history is bunk. It is rare to come out of a very rich man, but true. What does it matter whether Napoleon wins or is defeated? Who rules? The eternal moves, even not aware that these things are happening. What he is saying the same always. The crows caw, the sparrows twitter. And where do you think you are now? Ikku is a heart. From another dimension he attacks. And where do you think you are now? In a field dyed deep violet. The temple was known as Violet Field. Muras Kino. Ikku asks why? Why you call it that you are in a field dyed deep violet? Why you call it dyed deep violet? Ninagawa, Miss Conthus, morning glories, surf flowers, chrysanthemums, asters, flowers all over. He doesn't say, this is the name of your temple, Violet Field. Because names belong to the memory, to the past. And the master is asking now, where are you? All over, all around flowers, miscanthus, morning glories, saf flowers, chrysanthemums, asters. When you ask about the now, he talks about the now. And they are giving the whole place a deep violet color. Ikku is really impossible. He won't relax. He asks, and after they are gone, then these flowers are now here, okay, so you call it a deep violet color, violet field, but soon these flowers will be gone. Then what you will call it? And after they are gone, Ninagawa, it is Miyajino, the field of autumn flowering. This is to be understood. Clouds come and go. These are two aspects of the same coin. Flowers flower, then disappear. These are also two aspects of the same phenomenon. Absence and presence are not opposite. They are two aspects of the same. Now there are flowers, so it is called the violet field. And when the flowers are gone, people will say that this is the field of the absence of those autumn flowers. It will still be the violet field from another side, the absence. It happened, a Zen master loved his mother very much. In fact, before he became a Zen disciple, the father died. He wanted to become a Zen monk, so the mother said, but I am poor and I am alone and your father is dead. So he said, you don't worry. Even when I become a monk, I will be your son. You will be my mother. I am not renouncing you, I am not renouncing anything. So the mother allowed. He loved the mother very much. He will go to the market to purchase things for her. And people will laugh and they will say, we have never seen a monk purchasing things. Buddhist monks simply beg. And not only that, he will purchase meat, fish, and people will simply ridicule him that this is too much for the mother, not for himself, for the mother, because mother lied and she was not a nun or a religious person. Then the mother, seeing this, that people laugh, the whole town laughs, that a monk purchasing fish, she became a vegetarian. Because people laughed purchasing things, she said, you don't go, I will purchase myself. He continued to be a devoted son. Once he had gone to preach somewhere, and the mother died meanwhile, when he was not there, he came in right time. The dead body was there and people were getting ready to take it to the cemetery. He came near the body, said, Mother, so you have left? And he himself replied, yes, son. I have left the body. Then he said, don't be too much worried, because soon I will be also leaving the body. Then he replied from the mother's side, good, I will wait for you. And then he told to the people, I have said goodbye to my mother. The dialogue is over. Really, everything is over. Now you can take the dead body. So somebody asked, we cannot follow, what is the matter? To whom you were talking? He said, to the absence of my mother, because that is another aspect of her being. But why you were answering? He said, because she cannot answer. So I have to do both. Absence cannot answer. So I had to answer from her side. But she is there as she was before, only now in her absent aspect. So when Ikku asked, and after they are gone, said Ninagawa, it is Miyaj, you know, the field of autumn flowering, the same field, but in an absent aspect. Manifest, unmanifest, being, non-being, life, death, are two aspects of the same phenomena. There is nothing to choose. And those who choose are stupid and unnecessarily fall into suffering. Amazed, no. Ikku, again, the last question he asked, what happens in that field then, when flowers are gone? Ninagawa, the stream flows through, the wind sweeps over. Amazed at Ninagawa's zen-like speech, Ikku led him to his room and served him tea. Remember, zen-like. It is not exactly zen. He is a poet, and a very great poet of deep understanding. But the highest of poetry is just the beginning of zen, the beginning of religion. It is zen-like still. He understands, he has a certain glimpse. He is open. He feels. He has groped in the dark. And he knows a certain quality. Through his own inquiry, he has stumbled upon it. But still it is just a glimpse. Sometimes it can happen, a dark night and a sudden lightning, and you have a glimpse. Again there is darkness. This is what happens to the greatest poet. He is just on the boundary line. Where he can have glimpses of the beyond. But they are glimpses. They are zen-like. When they will become zen? They will become zen only when there are no more glimpses, but have become your very being. Then you live in them moment to moment. They don't come and go. Simply, they have become your innermost being. the way you are. It is not like lightning. It is full noontide. It is day. Sun is high in the sky and remains there. There is no more the possibility of darkness coming again. It is not a glimpse. It has become part of you. You carry it wherever you go. The inner light is burning now. You don't depend on accidents. You have settled in it. It has become your home. For example, trying to reach to the reality through the head is just like as if someone is trying to see through the ears. It is not possible. Ears can hear but cannot see. Trying to feel reality through the heart is like trying to see with the hands. The hands cannot see but can still give you a glimpse of what seeing can be. A blind person, if he loves a woman, touches her face, feels the curves, touches the body, feels the roundness and the warmth and the marble-like texture. A certain glimpse through the hands of seeing. Hands can give you a certain glimpse of seeing. Not exactly seeing, because how hands can see? They can only grope. But when you touch a face with closed eyes, you can feel the curves, the nose, the eyes, the way the face is. A poet is like a hand, feeling the nature of reality by the hands. Certain glimpses come to him, Zen-like. And a real man of Zen is like eyes. He is not groping. He has no need to touch by the hand. He can see. Amazed at Ninagawa's Zen-like speech, Ikku led him to his room and served him tea. These are symbols that you are allowed, that come nearer and closer, and served tea. Tea is a Zen symbol which means awareness, because tea makes you more alert, more aware. Tea has been invented by Buddhists, and they have used for centuries tea as a help for meditation. And tea is helpful. If you take a cup of tea strong and then sit for meditation, at least for 1 hour you will not feel sleepy. And you can remain aware. Otherwise, whenever you feel silent and sit relaxed, sleep comes. To avoid sleep, tea has helped. The story is that Bodhidharma was meditating on a certain mountain in China, called Ta. From that Ta comes the name Ti. That mountain can be pronounced as Ta or Cha. That's why in India it is called Chai or Cha. Bodhidharma was meditating and he was really a great meditator. He would like to meditate for 18 hours. It was difficult. He will feel again and again sleepy. The eyelids will drop again and again. So he cut his eyelids and threw them. So now there is no possibility to close the eyes. The story is beautiful. Those eyelids became the first seeds of tea, and a certain plant came out of those eyelids. Bodhidharma prepared the first tea in the world out of those plants. And he was amazed, because if you take those leaves and drink them, you can remain alert for longer periods. Then, for centuries, Zen people have been drinking tea. And tea has become a very, very sacred thing. So when a Zen master serves tea, it is a metaphor. He says, be more aware. You are on the right path, he says to Ninagawa, you are on the right path, but you are walking a little sleepily. Exactly you have found the direction, move in the same direction. Soon your Zen-like being will become Zen. But you will need to be more aware. Amazed at Ninagawa's Zen-like speech, you led him to his room and served him tea. That is serving awareness. A cup full of awareness. Just a symbol to indicate that become more aware. That's all that you need. Then he spoke this impromptu verse. I want to serve you delicacies. Alas, the Zen sect can offer nothing. It has two meanings. The ordinary meaning is, in Zen sect, delicacies are not allowed. Very simple food is allowed, rice, few vegetables, tea. No delicacies. So the first ordinary meaning is, I want to serve you delicacies. Alas, the Zen sect can offer nothing. This is the last effort of Ikkyu to penetrate him to the deepest core. Whether he can understand the meaning or not. The second meaning is, I want to serve you delicacies, alas, the Zen sect can offer only nothing. I can offer nothing. It can mean I cannot offer anything. Or it can mean I can offer you only nothing. Then nothing is offered. Awareness and nothingness are the two things. Two aspects of the same thing. The more you become aware, the more you feel being nothing. So first, Ikku serves tea to say become aware, and then he says, alas, I cannot offer anything, accept nothing. This is the last net thrown by the master. After you give tea, if the man was a pretender, he would have relaxed. He would have thought, I am accepted. The master led me to his tea room, offered me tea, served tea, I am relaxed. And after taking tea, he would have relaxed, because you cannot pretend for long. Pretension is such a strain that one relaxes. And when the master has served and given you tea, now there is no need to pretend, everything is finished. So the last breath, at which Ninagawa replied, the mind which treats me to nothing is the original mind, a delicacy of delicacies. No, he has really a Zen-like understanding. He was not a mere poet. Something of the real poetry of existence has happened to him. He could immediately understand. He could be immediate and could respond. He said, the mind which treats me to nothing is the original void, a delicacy of delicacies. Nothing is the delicacy of delicacies. More than that cannot be offered. That is the last delicacy, the last taste of existence itself. That is as if you have eaten God himself. The delicacy of delicacies. Deeply moved, the master said, Marson, you have learned much. This learning is not knowledge. Zen makes the difference between learning and knowledge. Let me explain it to you. Knowledge is borrowed. Learning is yours. Knowledge is through words, language, concepts. Learning is through experience. Knowledge is always finished. You know, it is complete. Learning is never complete. It is always on the way. Learning is a process. One goes on and on and on to the very last moment. One goes on learning. Knowledge is stopped somewhere, becomes the ego. Learning never stops. It remains humbleness. Knowledge is borrowed. You cannot deceive a master through your knowledge, because your words will be just on the surface. Deep down your being will show. Your words cannot hide you. And for a master, your words are transparent. Whatsoever you sow that you know, he always can see behind what is there. This man would have been caught by Ikku if he was a man of knowledge. But no, he was really a man of learning. He was learning. He was not pretending. Through many experiences of life, existence, he has learned much. Marson, said Ikkyu, you have learned much, and this is too much from a Zen master. Because they are very misers to say such things. When a Zen master says such a thing, he means it. And he can say such a thing only when he is really moved. When he really feels the authentic. Only then, otherwise not. Look into this story and feel yourself parallel to it. Have you learned, or only you have gathered knowledge? And let it become a very fundamental law that don't react through the knowledge. React, that is, respond spontaneously. Only then you will be closer and closer to me, and only then one day I can lead you and can serve you tea. Otherwise, you can be physically closer to me, that won't help. I have to serve awareness to you, and I have to give you the delicacy of delicacies, nothingness. Enough for today.